potentially solving a cold case should never be a sad or depressing event.
This is the Veritas 7 True Crime Podcast with your host, Kurt Dillon.
This podcast is like nothing else out there. It's true crime, but we don't present that in a sad or morose kind of manner.
The Veritas 7 features the most interactive and immersive true crime podcasting experience ever imagined.
Our whole goal is engagement with our audience. That's before, during, and after we record each episode. The whole purpose of this show is to actually try and solve these crimes, and we use real police documents to do that.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, so you'll know right away when each new episode goes live.
This is the only true crime podcast I know of where the audience can actually help solve the crime. We are all about trying to solve these crimes. Our whole team is dedicated to uncovering the truth. That's where the name Veritas comes from.
Let's get into the action. Take it away, Kurt.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me, your host, Kurt Dillon, for this part 2 of the Alphabet Murders Prime episode. In the last show, in part 1, we went through chapters 1, 2, and 3. We discussed the victimology of the case. We discussed the suspects and the crime scene, and then we went into the evidence. Now, in part 2, we're going to go into chapters 4 and chapters 5. Chapter 4, we're going to narrow in on a specific suspect or suspects, and in chapter 5, I'm going to make my best case as if I were a prosecuting attorney on who it is I believe the evidence points to that we should indict for these crimes. And then in chapter 6, we're going to actually have our live verdict where our panel and you are going to get the opportunity to vote, just like a jury, on who we all believe to be the guilty parties in this case. If we have a strong enough case, when all is said and done, we will be contacting the investigating officials there in Monroe County, New York, where this took place, and seeing if any of the information that we developed, found, or came to, or any conclusions that we came to, might in any way help them to actually file charges against somebody. Most of the time it won't, but our ultimate goal here is to solve some of these crimes. So if we feel we have enough stuff that we uncover that the investigators might be able to use it, we are absolutely going to turn that information over to the actual investigators at the end of our investigation. So, all that being said, sit back, buckle up, don't go anywhere, because Veritas means truth, and part 2 of the truth starts now.
I can't believe the price of dog food is getting outrageous. And if I want to save a few bucks, I have to carry a 50-pound bag of kibble up the stairs into my apartment. There has to be a better way.
There is. I'm so glad you said something. You poor thing, we've been using TummyTimePetSupplies.com for over a year now.
Tummy Time Pet Supplies? What's that?
TummyTimePetSupplies.com. They have all the major brands and most smaller brands as well. In fact, we not only get all of our dog and cat supplies there, but they also have everything we need for Brett's chinchilla, Ashley's ferrets, Haley's iguana, and even Jordan's pet tarantula.
Wow, they sell all that?
And more. But what's best about TummyTimePetSupplies.com is that they ship everything through Amazon Fulfillment. That means that everything you order gets delivered right to your door, and if you're an Amazon Prime customer, shipping is almost always free.
That really sounds incredible, but I bet it's super expensive. Mark just got laid off and I can't afford all those special conveniences for a while.
Nonsense. In fact, Tummy Time offers some of the most reasonable prices anywhere. You really have to be a whiz and coupon shopping to beat their everyday prices, and when they run sales, forget about it.
I can't believe it, an incredible selection, great prices, and right to your door service. So what do you think?
I think the next time I buy anything for my pets, I'm going to TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
I think that's a very wise choice.
Me too.
That's right. For all your pet needs, it's TummyTimePetSupplies.com. Remember TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
All right, everybody, thank you. Welcome back. We're going to get right into it because we have a lot of stuff. Now, in the previous chapter 2, where we had gone over the evidence, we talked about the suspects and we had talked about the circumstances of the crime, we had mentioned all the main suspects in this case. Obviously, Kenneth Bianchi, who was went on to be the Hillside Strangler. Do you guys remember the what was the fireman's name again? I can never remember his last name.
Dennis Termini.
Okay. We have Dennis Termini, who was the fireman that was the garage rapist, where they exhumed him and all that. He also had a white cat, and we know there was white cat hair on two of the victims. Now, I do want to mention also, in the course of our investigation, we turned up a book by a local author who lives there in Gates, which is a neighboring town to Rochester. And his name is Michael Benson, and he wrote a self-published book on the Alphabet Murders. He calls them the double initial murders, but he calls the book A Nightmare in Rochester. And he has a corresponding YouTube video that's about an hour and 40 minutes long where he goes through and does a public appearance at the Gates Library to an audience of some people. Of particular note, Carmen Colon's half-sister, Maria Colon, was there in attendance and made a little impromptu speech. A couple of the officers that were investigating different aspects of this case were there at the library, and they had some things to add. But what we found after investigating a lot of the things that Mr. Benson said are good and they're compelling and they're truthful. However, several of the things that he mentions and alludes to in his book, we've just found just don't meter out with the facts as we know them, facts that are in evidence and so forth. And we'll get into that a little bit more later on in the case. What was interesting, though, about Mr. Benson's presentation was that he mentioned that about 2 years, 2.5 years after the death of the last Alphabet killer victim, which was Michelle Maenza, in about 1975 or beginning in 1976, it was actually the beginning of 1976. Another girl, she was a 6-year-old girl, another double initial girl. Again, she was raped twice, actually, and strangled and murdered. However, several years in the future, I found it ironic when I heard of this story that nobody had ever included her. Her case went unsolved also until 2001. Her case has now been solved. But until 2001, it was also unsolved. And I thought it was really odd that nobody grouped her in with these other three girls. And I didn't really understand why that would have happened. Here you have another double initial girl, seemed like the same motive, the same scenario going on, and her case was unsolved, just like the other three girls. Nobody ever mentioned her in the same breath with the other three girls. So just something to remember and keep in perspective as we're going on in this case. Now, ultimately in 2001, a cigarette butt that was found near her body was evaluated for DNA and came back, and it came back to James Pressler, who was then very promptly arrested in Key West, Florida, and held at the Monroe County Jail, where he died of an apparent heart attack while he was awaiting extradition back to New York. He was actually formally charged with Michelle McMurray's death. They had also tested him at the time against the other double initial or alphabet murders, whatever you want to call them, of Carmen and they couldn't test him against Carmen, but they tested him against Michelle and against Wanda, and it turned out that he was not the contributor of the genetic material that was found on those girls, so he was ruled out in the alphabet killings. But he was actually charged with Michelle McMurray's death there in Rochester. And again, just a couple of days afterwards, while he was in the county jail there in Key West, Florida, he died of an apparent heart attack. So we have him, which I thought was a really compelling case. But even more compelling, is a gentleman by the name of Theodore F. Given. Now, there's a lot of crazy parallels with this guy. Not only did he do the same thing, he had the same kind of car. He had a 1965 Plymouth Valiant that looked very much like the car that was described. He lived in the neighborhood there, not far from where Michelle Maenza was abducted and where she lived. Ironically, on the day he was abducted, he was reportedly sleeping on his father's couch on Parcell Street there in Rochester, and Parcell Street happens to be his father's house on Parcell Street happens to be about 2 football fields away from Michelle Maenza's house. So some really eerie coincidences there as far as Given is concerned. Given definitely had a record of rapes and assaults, particularly on little girls. He's absolutely a pedophile. He did 10 years at one point for picking up 2 6-year-old girls in a park, telling them that he had baby bunnies in the trunk of his car, and did they want to come and see? When they approached the trunk of his car, he would push them in the trunk and shut the lid down and get in the car. He would bring them to an abandoned house there in Rochester, tie one of them up in the basement, bring the other one upstairs where he had a soiled mattress on the floor, and that's where he would violate the girls. And he did that and took turns with them. But then in an ironic twist, he would bring both of the girls back to the park and drop them off. So he let them live. Now, what's really interesting about this, and that I want to put into the record, for those of you who follow our Gifted Insights episodes with our amazing psychic, Gina Nisanoff, if you go back and you look at the very first Gifted Insights episode that we recorded some weeks ago, you will see that Gina tells us in that interview there where we're recording that episode that she sees the killer in a basement, bringing the girls to a basement and killing them in the basement. And also she sees a dirty mattress. So really interesting that we had not heard of this guy. This guy is not in any of the literature. If you scan and search and put in FOIA requests on the Alphabet Murders, you're going to get a whole bunch of stuff. You're going to get a whole bunch of pictures. You are not going to see anywhere in this case where this guy, Theodore F. Given, is even mentioned, not even loosely. He's not considered a suspect. He's not considered a loose suspect. He's not considered any kind of suspect, which is really crazy to me because what he did is exactly what happened. The only difference is not all of his victims had the same double initials. Those 2 6-year-old girls obviously did not. Also, 6-year-old girls in that case and 2 of them at the same time versus where he had separate incidences of these slightly older girls, 10 and 11. It's possible because at that time in that episode, if you'll remember, if you'll all go back, I had to go back and re-listen to it again. Gina also said in that show that she saw he might have had 2 of them at the same time. So it's also very possible that Gina was picking up on the abduction and the rapes of these 2 girls, because her scenario is identical to their dilemma. We know that he did not have Michelle Mayenza and Wanda Walkowitz at the same time. They were actually victimized about 7 months apart. So Wanda was already long since dead and interred when Michelle was abducted and abused and then finally murdered. So we know that definitely didn't have both of them at the same time. But Given here did have those 2 little girls at the same time in a house, in a basement with a dirty mattress. So really interesting on how that picked up like that. But in my opinion, and then we're going to talk about a couple of the other things that are very closely related with Given, he had to be a great target for Michelle Mayenza and Wanda Walkowitz. He could not be a suspect for Carmen Colon because, as we found out, Given was incarcerated at the time Carmen Colon in 1971 was abducted and raped and murdered. So he definitely is not a suspect in the Carmen Colon abduction and murder, but very viable for Wanda Walkowitz and then Michelle Mayenza some 7 months later. And we'll get into those a little bit later. There were also some other suspects that had gone around. There was a girl most recently on TikTok who thought that her grandfather might have been, his name was Ortiz, that he was loosely related to the family and that he had talked about Carmen a couple of times. That kind of creeped her out. So when he passed away not all that long ago, she made sure that she had DNA samples taken of him to compare against the control that they have, the sample that was found on Wanda Walkowitz's body. And of course, he turned out to be genetically excluded from being the contributor of the semen that was found on Wanda Walkowitz. We also have Joseph Nasso. Now, Nasso is a really, really intriguing suspect in this case. Again, lived in Rochester, was just a really depraved, committed a lot of heinous, atrocious acts. He even had a diary of death is what the law enforcement officers called it, where he mentioned a lot of girls that he either victimized or was fantasizing about victimizing. And our three little girls were mentioned in there by description. What's also really appealing about Nassau is that even after he moved out to California and continued his murderous ways, every single one of his victims, the 12 victims that he was credited with killing out in California, all had the same initials. And if that's not eerie enough, actually one of them was also named Carmen Colon. But of course, she was an adult prostitute, not a young girl. So very weird how that shook out. But of course, now we wanted to know how weird. So I actually went and looked, and it turns out that Carmen Colon, not only is it a unisex name, there are a lot of men named Carmen too. But Carmen Colon is one of the more common names of Hispanic origin. I believe I checked it. It was the 43rd most common name of Hispanic origin there is. So take it with a grain of salt. You know, there's a lot of people in the world named Carmen Colon. In fact, if you Google the name, you're going to come up with obituaries for a ton of people. You know, Facebook profiles for people that are still alive now that have the name. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of them. You have to, just to get any kind of information, even on the poor girl that died in 1971, you have to do a very specific search on public databases for her age and the year that she died, or include the term alphabet killings or double initial murders. So eventually, out of this pool of people, you have Bianchi and you have the fireman and you have Nasso and you have Given and you have Ortiz, which was the TikTok girl, Alexis, her grandfather. You have all of these suspects. Ultimately, many, many of them were ruled out because of DNA. We also know that Carmen's uncle, Miguel, he could not have killed Wanda. He could have killed Michelle. He was not available in the area to kill Wanda, but he was available in the area to kill Michelle. The problem is Michelle's murder and Wanda's murder have now been genetically linked to one another. So they absolutely know that Michelle and Wanda were killed by the same person or people. The outlier in all of these cases is Carmen. Now, what I've read in a couple of reports that we got as far as the FOIA requests. Now, in New York, it's not called FOIA with an A. It's called FOIL with an L. They call it Freedom of Information Law in the state of New York. So when we got our FOIL requests back from Monroe County and Wayne County, New York, as well as the New York State Police, they do mention in there, in some of the reports, about, you know, some of these suspects and how Miguel was not available. It is mentioned in there, and Mr. Benson, in his book seminar that he conducted there at the Gates Library in that video, he claims that the investigator that's active on the case now, the cold case investigator that's working the alphabet killing case right now, has evidence that convinces him that these three girls were all killed by the same person. But they will not, that's part of the evidence that they will not release to the public. So Benson mentions this in the thing. I've also heard that in a couple of the reports that we got in the FOIL requests from New York State pertaining to the case, that they have, even in our video that's on our YouTube page, one of the investigating officers that's there claims that he has evidence that thoroughly convinces him that these three girls were all killed by the same person. Obviously, I'm not privy to that information. We aren't. We tried to get it. We tried to get somebody to allude to it, to at least tell us what kind of information it is, so we could do a kind of a cursory, independent investigative research on the nature of that evidence, but we could not. So it's great that this investigator is convinced that it's evidence that links all three of these cases in his mind. I, however, do not see it. Now, all of the reports that we've also gathered in this case have claimed that Michelle and Wanda's bodies both were covered with white cat hair. Benson, for the first time ever in his speech there when he's plugging his book at that seminar at the Gates Library, mentions that they know definitively that all three girls were covered with white cat hair. And he even goes on, he doubles down on that statement by claiming that that is the only solid evidence that they have. Case that links all these cases and makes them so that they are almost certainly from the same killer. I don't believe that this investigator that's keeping the link, the missing, I call it the missing link in this case, because there's a missing link that clearly separates Carmen Colon's murder from the murders of the other two. You know, you have the coincidence of the double initials. You have the fact that they all lived in Rochester. You have the fact that they were all Catholic. We have now been able to confirm that all three girls were on public assistance at the time. My first hypothesis in this case was that if the killer, if it's a common killer for killers for all three girls, then the killer would have to either were they, because they didn't go to the same church, they didn't go to the same schools, they didn't, weren't involved in any of the same programs. The only thing that they all had in common was that last element. So I don't believe that they were done by the same killer. Because of that, I cannot assume, I don't believe that he would just keep the fact that there was white cat hair on Carmen's body as their big secret to try and identify a killer to get somebody to confess or whatever. I can't believe that's the element. Now, Benson is convinced that there was white cat hair on all three victims, which would physically tie them all together. But again, every report that we have been able to find, every piece of information that we've been able to pull through FOIL requests with New York State authorities, as well as the Monroe and Wayne County authorities, none of it mentions white cat hair on Carmen. There are also differences, what I feel are pretty substantial differences, in the crime scenes. Carmen was beaten, and she was beaten badly. Her skull was crushed. She was scratched over 80% of her body with what the coroner on the scene reported as human fingernails. So she wasn't scratched with an inanimate object. She was scratched with human fingernails, and she was scratched over 80% of her body. None of the other girls had that. The other girls were beaten. There was some bruising on them, particularly in the rape parts, in their genital areas, where they suffered the trauma of and indignity of being molested and forcibly raped right before they were killed, or possibly even right after they were killed or at the time they were killed. We don't know. But we know that the rapes occurred at least close to the time of death. So it was either right before, during, or right after the girls were killed that they were sexually assaulted. That is part of the record. So really fascinating about that. Again, that's the suspect pool that we have that's out there. Bianchi and the fireman and Nasso have all been genetically ruled out as the contributors of the DNA that was on Michelle and Wanda. There was no genetic material that was found on Carmen's body or on her clothes. So they don't have the same material. However, like I believe I mentioned in part one of this show, Carmen was the only victim that was found unclothed. Wanda and Michelle were both reclothed after they were murdered. And this is important because not only because this shows different patterns and different motives and actions by the killer, but more importantly, Carmen's clothes were found in freestanding rainwater about 1,000 feet away from her body. That's important because the genetic material that was found on Wanda and Michelle was found on their underpants. And ironically, Carmen's pants were found in freestanding water. To this day, Carmen's underwear have never been recovered. So they remain missing. They never turned up as a result of any search, which it's very possible there could have been genetic material that was left on Carmen's undergarments too, that would have linked her to the other two cases. But the underwear are missing and they've never been recovered. They did find her pants, but they never found her underwear. And the underwear on the other two girls is where the DNA samples were recovered that they're using to this day to both label suspects as suspects and also to clear them. It's because of that evidence we know that Nasso and Fireman and Kenneth Bianchi have been excluded as possible suspects because of their DNA. Even though the whole scenario with Nasso, it's really, when you think of a town the size of Rochester, I just have to digress for a minute. You have to keep in mind now that we're also saying definitively, since none of those guys were the killer, you had the garage rapist in a city of 300,000 people in the early 1970s. You had the garage rapist, a fireman. You had Joseph Nazo, this double initial killer, rapist, heinous maniac. And you had Kenneth Bianchi, who would graduate to go on to be the Hillside Strangler, all living in Rochester at the same time. It's insane to think of that, that you had that much. It was one of the bigger cities in New York, but it's nowhere near the size of New York City. It's nowhere near the size of L.A. It's nowhere near the size of Atlanta or the Chicago or any of the big primary. It's not anywhere near the size of any of the big major cities in America. And yet you have all of these serial killers and mass serial rapists living within the 17 square miles that make up Rochester and Monroe County, which I think that's a statistical anomaly in and of itself, that you have that many depraved people all living in a strange thing. Also, I found interesting when I interviewed one of the law enforcement officers that works up there on the case that was working. He's retired now, but he was working on the case back then, very old. He actually said off the record, when they look back in 1971 and 1973, they didn't have sexual offender databases like they have now. Even people that were convicted of sexual offenses were not required to register as sex offenders. So there was no registry. That being said, when these murders started happening and they went about looking for convicted sex offenders in the area, this officer told me that there were over 250 convicted sex offenders that were living in the general vicinity of Rochester. Hit that with the serial killers. I mean, it's really crazy.
Yeah, I do think I would almost say yes, all college campuses have serial rapists, especially ones that have big university or on-campus living or Greek life. I would say there's probably serial rapists in almost every fraternity. They just don't get caught. Rape is the most underreported crime and the least likely to be solved. People, drug people. It's like an epidemic. I do think it's crazy that there were all these that were caught and had crazy MOs rape-wise in a small city, but I don't think it's may be that big of a statistical anomaly that Rochester had this many.
Is there a big school in Rochester?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a campus of the State University of New York, which is pretty large. So they call it SUNY. It's a large school. It's a public university. So yeah, they have some pretty big schools there.
And I wouldn't just say that it's mainly college men. It's men of that age, like early adulthood to the late 20s or early mid 30s or something. It's that demographic of who a lot of these sexual offenders can be, not necessarily towards children, more people of their same age, but I do think that it's not that big of a statistical anomomaly for one town to have, especially if there's
I think to have this in there though, we need the statistical data though, right?
Definitely. But there's no accurate statistical data on rape. It just doesn't really exist.
Right. That's definitely true. And also when you consider of all of these suspects that we're talking about, Bianchi and the firemen and whatever, none of them, including Nasso, victimized young children, prepubescent children. All of their victims, the closest one was Bianchi had one 12-year-old victim. Out of all of the 28 women that he went on to victimize, there was one of them that was 12, almost like she was an accident. Almost all the rest of them were all older, prostitutes and people like that. Same thing with Nasso. Almost all of his victims were adult prostitutes or teenage girls that were at the upper echelon of their teens, 18, 19, 20.
Yeah. And there's a difference between an old 12 and a young 12. I was 5'5" at the age of 12, but these girls that we were covering were 11 and 4 feet tall and 65 pounds. It really just depends who they're targeting. And right. Also, I'm not kind of sure what kind of town Rochester was back then. Was there not really pro-social activities for these guys to be doing? What access to mental health care was there? I think there are a lot of things that could have gone into making this a really magnet towards this kind of sexual offending.
Oh, I agree. And back in the 70s, mental health was hushed. Nobody wanted to talk about mental health like they do now. There was none. So your answer to that was, you know, there really was no help for people that were going through this kind of stuff, especially if they were the victims of some kind of sexual abuse, too. It really just wasn't there. It was the kind of thing, especially rape back then, was very, you know, we don't talk about that. We don't tell anybody about that. Ellie, what do you think?
Well, I was just gonna kind of touch on Nasso and one of the reasons why they actually thought, even though the women that he had normally attacked were, you know, normal aged women and not young girls, I think they thought, well, maybe when he was in Rochester in the early days, that he maybe had started with young girls and then progressed into women. But obviously, we know now after, you know, doing all of the investigative digging, that probably wasn't the case. But I think originally that's how they rationalized, you know, him being a possible suspect.
Right.
I really don't think it was Nasso. Also, there is like some, at least what I've heard, anecdotal evidence on like people who've been caught with like child rape or like engaging in child, I hate saying child prostitution because it's not, you know what I mean? Some sort of people who are buying into child sex trafficking. They go, first they start off with normal age prostitutes, and then that feeds like their sex addiction, and they slowly go more into the more, quote, deviant stuff. I don't think it really goes the other way that much.
Right. Well,
I agree. I think this was the only way they could rationalize why they even thought they could tie him in because of the names in the book. But, you know, that was their theory. But, you know, I agree that I didn't believe that he was our suspect in this.
Right. And one thing, I've actually written papers on this throughout my collegiate education, because as a forensic psychologist, you study a lot of deviant sexuality. You study a lot of the statistics that are reported. And of course, they are never complete, because there's a big, huge population of rape victims that are never going to come forward, and they're never going to say anything. So, you know, the statistics are always skewed. But on the cases that we have, another thing that's really amazing about sex abuse and these pedophiles and just basic, you know, rapists in general, is that no two are really exactly the same. They all, unlike murder, you know, you're either going to be a strangler or a stabber or a shooter or a choker or a garrotter or whatever. Everybody falls in love with their own method. If you're going to be a serial killer, you fall in love with your own method of killing it. Rapists, not so much. What I found is that if you go back and you look at the documented cases, especially rapists that have multiple victims, there's a few common threads that you'll see in the way maybe there's a certain way they like to tie them up. Maybe there's a certain way they like to talk to them or whatever. But if you really get graphic and you get into the interviews, the candid interviews with the victims and with the suspects themselves, you'll see that you have one guy that raped 15 women and gets convicted for all 15. It's an almost mathematical certainty that each one of those 15 is going to be different in some important way, which is different than murderers or pretty much any other kind of serial criminal. One of our listeners mentioned in about different kinds of kinks and different kind of fetishes and different kind of philias. And that's exactly right. You know, one day you'll feel like he'll feel like a foot fetish. Maybe the next day he'll have a fascination with her hair. Or, you know, and I've seen crazy things. It's not just the kind of things that you see in like horror movies. And some of them will have like a fascination with her skin. And I'm not talking about like the sensitive, like sexual parts of her skin or the erotic, what you consider the erogenous zones or the erotic parts of her skin. I'm talking about just like a freckle on her cheek or on her forehead or whatever. And some of them really, really focus in on this, and they look for the one thing that just really attracts them about every one of their victims. And the hysterical thing is it's really unique to every victim. It's almost like they explore their victims' bodies like it's a treasure hunt, looking for something that they find erotic, that's uniquely erotic to this victim that wasn't uniquely erotic to the last one. And this is where the psychopathy of taking trophies starts kicking in. And you have, you know, people start talking about they want mementos because they want to be able to relive that. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. But a lot of the pathology is different when they're attacking and raping prepubescent girls. There is, especially in New York, because I lived there most of my life. So when I was going to school, I learned in New York schools. And when you learn in a state, you learn more about that state's laws pertaining, because it's just easier. Everything is right there and it's readily available. New York's legal system is in tears as far as rape and statutory rape is concerned. There is one set of penalties for any kind of sexual contact or sexual touching for a victim that's up to the age of 11. Then you have a separate category if the victim is between the ages of 11 and 13. Then if the victim is older than 13 but younger than 16, there's another category. And then, of course, there's the final category. If the victim is older than 16 or younger than 18, that's when New York has what they refer to as the Romeo and Juliet law, which means as long as it's consensual, you can have consensual sex with a 16-year-old in New York, provided, obviously, that it was actually consensual and that the offender is not more than 4 calendar years older than the victim. So if you're 20 in New York and you have sex with a 16-year-old, that is, calendar means everything. So if her birthday is January the 20th and your birthday is January 21st and you're 4 years and 1 day older than her, you're going to jail. But if your birthday is January the 19th, you're good. It's not a crime. It's not even a misdemeanor.
Texas has some really weird laws like that too. I got called into jury duty one time. And there's actually a time frame between the rapes too. If you know that there's the age limitations, and if there's a certain time period between the occurrences, it can bump it all the way up to life.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Same thing there in New York. And it's really interesting. So college campuses, I believe, just the issue with college campuses, I think, is just because of the logistics of a college campus that makes it a breeding ground for rape. Because you have a lot of partying going on. You have a lot of young people all in one area that aren't really known for making the best life choices yet. A lot of them are confused. A lot of them are really, sexually aroused because of all the stuff that's going on around them or whatever. So really easy for somebody who is pathologically minded to introduce a date rape drug or introduce some kind of long con manipulation scam, or to do like a Ted Bundy and put a cast on your arm and go to a sorority house and try and get the sorority sisters to let you in, thinking that you're hurt and you ran out of gas and you got a cast on, or you're trying to play on somebody's sympathy. So there's a lot of scenarios where people, these twisted minds, have decided to choose college campuses as their breeding ground. I believe college campuses are picked because you have a lot of, really beautiful girls that are usually away from their parents and away from any kind of protection in abundance there. If you sit around on a college campus long enough, you're going to see a susceptible potential victim walk by you. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, and there's even a neighborhood that is not a college campus here in Dallas called Deep Ellum, and the date rape and drugging there is insane. Like, we don't really know who the guys are, but the girls are all like, shouldn't be there because they have a fake ID, or like they're young 20s or something like that.
Right. Well, and now too, in modern day now, we see this a lot more and more with women being the offenders against male victims that are teens. Almost once a week, there's another female teacher, a grammar school or elementary school teacher, that's getting arrested for having intercourse with her students. So one of our listeners just typed in the chat page and agreed with you that Deep Ellum is the worst. Yeah, so I mean, that's it's bad. But again, anywhere where you have that type of demographic, where you have, you know, a lot of young women that aren't really security minded or security conscious in one confined area where you can go there and you can hunt. It's like going to a prime deer spot when deer season opens up. You bring your long gun and you just sit there and wait, climb up in a tree. Sooner or later, one of them is going to walk by. And it's really the same. You know, I don't like to liken it to deer hunting, but it really is. One of our people wrote in and said that it's not very classy, but, you know, it's a shame because there's no other place to club that's safe. And it's true. You know, it's true. And so then you have communities that want to open and establish juice bars, you know, because a lot of your college students are still not 21. So they don't want to promote nightclubs that have alcohol for obvious reasons, because that's a breeding ground in and of itself. You have a lot of young women and young men, but mostly young women that already have, you know, they're not the wisest about their own personal security to begin with. And now you have them consuming alcohol that's just going to lower their inhibitions even more and make them even more susceptible to being gamed and manipulated and so forth. So I know when I was in school, in college, they had a big thing where they were opening up juice bars all over the place where you could go and they would sell non-alcoholic drinks and beverages, and they try to get real creative with what they made, where they would do, like when I was a kid, Jell-O shots was the big thing. That was a big thing in the real bars. So what the juice bars would do is they would do Jell-O shots, but just with real Jell-O. So it wasn't alcoholic and it wasn't spiked, but they would put the Jell-O in test tubes and people would slam the Jell-O shots out of test tubes. So they used to do all that kind of stuff to try and compensate for that. So really strange. There's a lot of demographics going on. So now I want everybody to tell me, as we get ready to close out chapter 4 and move into chapter 5, where we're going to make our arguments, everybody take your time, take your turn, weigh in, let me know and let our audience know what you're feeling is the scenario and the most likely suspects out of the pool of suspects that we have now.
Well, I wanted to add to what you were saying with the possibility of there being more than one killer with these three girls and the differences in the crime scenes. One other thing that was noted was that Carmen did not have food in her stomach, and the other two girls had been fed by their abductor or murderer.
Absolutely. So another weird thing with that. Yes, Carmen didn't have any food in her stomach. Wanda did have food in her stomach. It was custard. And the weird thing about custard, we all know it's well documented that Michelle was taken to the hamburger joint and had ground beef and onion in her stomach. But Wanda had custard. And Wanda's mother spoke out after the autopsy report was released and said that she can't understand how that could be, because Wanda absolutely hated custard and never, ever would have voluntarily ingested custard of her own free will. So really weird that there was custard in Wanda's stomach. And apparently, according to her mother, she absolutely detested custard.
So there were several differences between the crime scenes with the Carmen and then the other two girls. And in fact, I think they called in an FBI profiler to kind of examine that. And I think Paige has some pretty good info on that, right, Paige?
Yes, I do. Just one second. Okay. So his name is Profiler Hazelwood. So again, he believes that the initials have nothing to do with it. He thinks it was strictly because of their age, gender, vulnerability and opportunity. So here's the profile he gave for Carmen Colon. He said that the killer probably knew her, was between the ages of 25 and 30, low to average intelligence, abused alcohol, prone to explosive and violent behavior, and he thinks that the motive here was anger. That's what he said. But with Wanda and Michelle, he said that this person would be above average intelligence, might have previous arrests for sexual offenses, but these would be like lesser crimes such as nuisance and window peeking. He said that he did show some sort of respect to the victims as they were found dressed and Carmen was not afforded this respect. And he said that the motive here was probably functional, which means that these people must be killed because they can identify me, and that's a threat to me, rather than the anger that was demonstrated in Carmen with the scratching, the broken skull, and like the vertebrae fractures, right, and other stuff like that.
Yeah, and the way he strangled her too from the front.
Yes, it's just way more personal.
Opposed to the back.
Yeah. It's more personal, yeah.
Sure.
Right. Absolutely. And then, of course, also with Carmen, we have the autopsy results, which prove that Carmen had been the victim of long-term sexual abuse that had already healed prior to the trauma of that day when she was abducted. So that adds another whole element to the fact that this girl, led a traumatized life prior to this date too, as most of our victims in this case did. All three of these girls really had a rough first decade of their life there. So it's sad how that all played out.
Paige, did he say that the killer may have known Carmen?
Yes, he did say that.
Okay. But he that wasn't the case with the other two, right?
No, he thinks that, they were more killed because he thinks that they can identify him rather than, I think it was like the main thing was like, I'm going to like abduct and rape these girls, but they're killed because they can identify me, rather than the rage shown through Carmen's.
Right. And that's obviously a viable theory. So now let's talk suspects. Now we have a listener that wrote in here, and it says that she believes that it's two different killers, and especially considering the previous abuse on Carmen and also the time frame between her murder and the others. Now, if in case all of you at home didn't get that, Carmen was killed in November of 71. Wanda was the next victim, but wasn't for a year and a half later. So it was April of 73 when Wanda was abducted and killed. And then it was about 7 months later in November of 73 when Michelle Maenza was abducted and killed. So you do have a gap of time in between these killings. All the profiling in the world we could try and use to explain why we think that is. Maybe the offender got in a little bit of trouble, nothing really that serious, where he ended up having to go away and do a year in jail somewhere, or a year and a half in jail somewhere, or whatever. And kind of the same thing for the 7 month gap in between Wanda and Michelle. We don't know. So it's good. Thank you for writing in with that. We appreciate it. So what about everybody else? What are you thinking out of all of these suspects that we have? Who do you think is the hottest? Do we have a consensus that believes that it's two separate killers, or do we have anybody that believes that it's one killer did all?
It's definitely multiple killers, for sure.
Gotcha. Okay. What's the most evidence that leads you to believe that, April?
Well, first of all, I don't think that any of the suspects that we know of, such as Termani, and they were all exonerated. So, I mean, it's not them. I think it's someone totally separate that they did not catch, for sure. But definitely, in Carmen's case, it's I believe it was her uncle, Miguel Colon.
Right. Okay. If you don't mind, what's the most compelling aspect of Miguel as a suspect that is most poignant to you?
Well, he had no good alibi, number one. Number two, weeks prior to Carmen's abduction, he purchased a car that was closely matching the vehicle seen by an eyewitness. I think that's, I believe was it the Pinto?
Yeah, Miguel had a Pinto.
Yeah, yeah. And when they did a search on his car, actually, they discovered that the interior and the exterior were both extensively cleaned.
Right.
and the trunk had been washed with some kind of cleaning solution. I'm not sure if it was bleach or something like that, but
right.
And then, I mean, I know they say the doll, you know, that that's her uncle, you know, there very well could have been a doll inside there, but I just think that's kind of
right. Well, and not only that, it's her uncle that's in a sexual relationship with her mother. So exactly. he's living in the house with her mother. So obviously he's going to, at some point, she's going to be in that car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Right. Okay. Cool. I mean, all right, Matt, what do you got? Oh, go ahead. Yeah. You still go ahead.
No, we're good.
All right, Matt, what do you got?
I agree with April. I think the crime scenes definitely show there's two killers. We have different cars from eyewitnesses. We have their clothes differently. There was no DNA on Carmen. We have food. They were strangled differently. The time frame, and I believe she's spot on with Carmen's uncle being the prime suspect. He is. His behavior was very mysterious right after Carmen's death. And his car was cleaned. He had Carmen's doll in it, you know, which some of that could be explained. But I think April hit the nail on the head there. This guy's definitely on the top of my list for Carmen, but we know he can't be for the other two.
Right. And just to clarify, too, a little bit of that evidence that we're talking about there. It's funny. What Matt was referring to there was that just a couple of days after Carmen's death, Miguel had to leave the area and go to Puerto Rico, so he said, which a lot of people took up as flight, that he was, you know, scared because he had done this, so he took off. Now,
that was 4 days after the murder, yeah.
Well, that's what all the reports say. But then yeah. We have that video that was the presser that was released for his book there by Benson, Michael Benson, the author of that book, where Carmen's sister Maria was there. She claims that it wasn't 4 days after, it was quite a while after it happened, and that he didn't run, that there was a death in the family in Puerto Rico that he had to go take care of, at number one. And also she added the fact that because the family was on public assistance and he was living there in the house and had a job, but he wasn't on her case. We're talking about Carmen's mother now, that they were technically guilty of fraud. And he was scared after what happened to Carmen that the investigators and the police were going to come into the house and look around and find out that he was living there and that the mother was collecting social services for her and Carmen. So basically he took off as a result of that. So, you know, really weird that you have all of that. And again, Carmen's sister, who now Maria is Carmen's half sister. They have the same mother, but different fathers. Miguel, I have to let everybody know, is Maria's father. So if you didn't catch this in the first episode, Carmen's father and his mother and her mother split. And his biological brother, Miguel, moved in and went on to have a long-lasting affair with Carmen's mother. The result of that live-in affair was Maria, Carmen's half-sister. And she's the one that was at this thing. So Maria, Miguel's biological daughter, was the one that was actually there at this presser with Michael Benson talking about you know, this case and doing everything she could to proclaim her father's innocence. It's another story, how many people were buying it. And we're going to get into a little bit more about that too in the next chapter. Ellie, what about you? What are you thinking? Who are you liking as suspects for this?
Well, I'm in agreeance with you on Miguel for Carmen, and really strongly feel compelled to go with the suspect that was in close proximity to the girls. In fact, just a few, I believe you had mentioned a few houses down from the girls and was sleeping on his father or grandfather's couch. And there was a lot of other evidence that it seems that you've kind of dug up over the last few days that's been, I think, shocking to all of us in this case. But I was kind of leaning heavily towards that. If you could refresh his name to me on that one.
Oh, that was Theodore Given. And we're definitely going to talk a little bit
Given
more
about the other two girls.
Right. Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about a little bit more about Mr. Given here in a little bit. But again, we know he's not responsible for Carmen because he was incarcerated at
Correct.
The time of Carmen's abduction and murder.
Yeah. So I truly believe that this is two separate suspects and two completely different cases in that regard. One was very personal, I believe, with Miguel, and then the other two, you know, like you said, we'll discuss later. But I'm with everyone else on the team on this one.
Right. Gotcha. And now one of our listeners wrote in and asked if Given's DNA was tested against Wanda and Michelle. And we know for a fact that it was not. We also know that there was never any DNA sample that was taken for Miguel because there was no DNA that was recovered on Carmen. Now, again, ironically, that could be intentional because out of all of our victims, Carmen is the only one whose underpants were never recovered. Her pants were recovered at the crime scene about 1,000 feet away from where her body was recovered, but her underpants were never recovered. And the DNA samples that were found on the other two girls were recovered off of their underpants. So interesting that the one item that yielded DNA in the other two cases was absolutely missing in Carmen's case. And it's even more intriguing that to this day that those underwear have never been found. So, you know, somebody deliberately took them for a reason, whether or not they, too many people weren't thinking about DNA back in 1971. When Carmen was killed, it certainly wasn't admissible in any kind of court or wasn't really a known science. So, I find it hard to believe that they would have taken the underwear because they were afraid they were going to, you know, get caught for DNA. But they did know that, leaving sperm could definitely get you blood typed and it could help narrow down the field a little bit. So it's very possible that if they knew that they had ejaculated on her undergarments, that it was a smart thing to get rid of them so that that evidence no longer existed. Paige, last up, what do you think? What are you thinking about this as far as the suspects go?
Okay, y'all are going to hate me. None of them. But if I had to pick one, it'd be the Gibbons guy. But I'm not getting the vibe that it's any of them, honestly.
I got you.
But we know it can't be... We know it can't be at Givens on Carmen because Givens was incarcerated during Carmen's murder.
We can say that definitively, yes.
Right. Yes. I mean, we know Givens didn't kill Carmen, so that's get that. What are you thinking about for Carmen's murder?
Probably the uncle, too, I have to say, with the whole, you know, sexual abuse in the past and, like, the very personal motive there seemed to be. And, you know, absconding and the car and a lot of stuff we said in part one.
Right.
You know, Kurt, I can tell you this, you know, we're, you know, kind of keyboard warriors at this point. But two detectives from Rochester went to Peru, or it was Peru, right?
No, Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, my bad. Scratch that. We know two detectives went down to Puerto Rico from Rochester to interview him. And they felt very compelled that he was the guy. And it was so influential that they were able to contact Rochester and they actually extradited him back for interviews. So, you know, it's not just us that think that too. The two detectives thought it as well.
Right. The thing is, I think that they used that term incorrectly. I heard them use that term that he was extradited. You can't be extradited without being charged with a crime. And he was never charged with a crime, nor was he ever incarcerated. So the only way you get extradited is if you're in jail and they need to move you from one state to another. So technically, it's impossible for him to have been extradited. What they did is they went down there and they interviewed him and they convinced him to come back.
So do you think the citizens of New York, in a sense, paid for his trip from Puerto Rico back to New York, or he came back on his own accord?
No, I believe he came back on his own accord. I believe he came back on his own accord. Like I said, again, now there's no saying, you know, the law enforcement might have offered him a plane ticket. You know, obviously there's no train. You can't take a bus from Puerto Rico. You can't take a train from Puerto Rico. So he's got to fly. Now, obviously, as part of the deal, they might have offered him a plane ticket that the taxpayers paid for. But again, we know that Miguel was never officially charged with the crime and he was never incarcerated for it. So, you know, it is what it is. But for whatever reason, they convinced him to come back. It also, you know, if you were under suspicion of having committed this crime, Puerto Rico would really be a stupid place to go, because even though it's not technically a state, it is for all other intents and purposes. So, you know, Puerto Rico is not going to protect you if you're wanted by any of the 50 states. So, I mean, going to flee there really wouldn't be a smart choice. Out of all the places in the world you can go if you were really trying to avoid capture and stay away from the cops. But we're definitely going to get into that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for a very compelling Chapter 4, Closing in on a Killer. Stay tuned. Chapter 5 is coming up right after this. We are going to get into building the case, where we are going to eliminate the extraneous suspects that we absolutely know did not have anything to do with this crime. And no matter how good of a suspect they were, or no matter how depraved of an individual they were, we simply know, because they've either been ruled out through DNA or through some other means. And we're going to focus in on what I believe, as the prosecutor of this case, what I believe would be the ultimate goal of who we would request indictments on from a grand jury, to go into our chat rooms, discuss it, vote on it, and weigh in, so that when we do Chapter 6 live on Friday night, you are going to be able to have a voice in whether or not you think you agree with our decisions or you have your own. And we're going to add those poll results and read them on the air and add them into our decision. So you're not going to want to miss that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me, your host, Kurt Dillon, for this Chapter 5 of the Alphabet Murders. We're getting close. You know, you want to stick around. This is where it's really starting to get good. Remember, Chapter 6 is the verdict. After tonight's episode, we are going to ask you to go to our Facebook chat group. We're going to ask you to enter one of the chat rooms and cast your vote. There are going to be polls that are set up in there as to who you would ask to indict and why. So you definitely want to stay tuned. You want to listen to the evidence that we present. Feel free to conduct your own investigation independently. So, ladies and gentlemen, we want you to pay close attention to the evidence that we're going to present and the voice that we're going to use to present it, to do your own investigation. But you absolutely want to make sure that Friday night at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, you tune in to our Facebook chat group. That's facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. You want to go live into the chat rooms and you want to be there when we cast our live verdict on Facebook Live. You don't want to miss it. It's going to be a great event. You're going to be able to participate. We're going to listen to your poll results. So it's going to be a great thing. And again, this is absolutely going to change the way that you take in your podcast, because there's no other podcast that does it like this, where you are directly involved and have a say in what you think, where you think the evidence leads, and are able to conduct your own home sleuth internet investigation. So we hope that you're enjoying it so far. We're going to get right to it. Again, with us today, we have Matt Sloniker, we have Steph Clark, April Hill, Paige Smith, Ellie Sherrill, and me, your host, Kurt Dillon. You don't want to miss it. It's going to get good. This is where we narrow it down, building a case, right here on the Veritas 7. Sit back, buckle your seatbelts, because Veritas means truth, and the truth starts now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. We're back. Appreciate you joining us today with our panel. We are getting ready for go time here, as the first part of this chapter is going to be the panel making their best case to me as to why I should ask for indictments on certain suspects and why. We're going to eliminate all of the riffraff, all the people that it absolutely can't be, all the people that we really think it's not, and we're going to narrow it down to what we feel are the best suspects, the most viable suspects that we might actually have a fighting chance of getting an indictment against when all is said and done. So that all being said, Matt, why don't you go ahead and set it off?
You know, Kurt, I have investigated these three murders intensively. We have a lot of data. We have autopsies. We have suspects that we've researched. Rochester at the time had some pretty hardcore guys living in it, some well-known killers. We got Nasso, we got Bianchi, we got the firemen, and we've exhumed the firemen, and we went through the other guys, and they are, through DNA, we're able to rule them out. But in Carmen's case, we have one particular guy that we really want to present to you, and it's her uncle, Miguel.
Okay. And what is the most compelling evidence, in your opinion, that casts guilt on Miguel?
So Miguel is a character in general. He had some kind of weird behavior with the family anyhow. To set a background, he was with his brother's wife, his brother's ex-wife. So, you know, he doesn't have the greatest character. Some of the witnesses, we have documented witness reports that saw a Pinto during Corman's capture, and Miguel had a Pinto that matched the color. And after we looked at Miguel's Pinto shortly after the crime, he had cleaned the entire car inside and out using many chemicals, including bleach, in her. So he's trying to clean something up. In the car, we also found one of Carmen's dolls. It could have been used to lure her into the car. And 4 days after this happened, he hightails it to Puerto Rico. He got the heck out of Dodge. And we have documented that he told someone in Rochester that he had to leave Rochester because he did something very bad.
Right. Right. Okay. Good. Fair enough. April, what do you got?
Well, I believe that Miguel is the main suspect for Carmen's death. I know I had given some reasons why. One thing that I didn't say before was I remember Miguel had reported to a friend 2 days after Carmen passed, and he expressed that he needed to leave the country due to he had done something bad in Rochester. And I thought that was kind of, I don't know, that was kind of suspicious to me.
Right.
And as far as the other guys, Nassau and what are the other guys' names?
We got Bianchi, and we got the fireman, and we got...
Yeah, well, Termini, Bianchi, and Nassau, they were all exonerated, so their DNA was tested, and there was no match. What I do want to look into is Givens. Theodore F. Givens. I would love to get more information on him to see if he could be the possible murderer of Wanda and Michelle.
Yeah. One thing I forgot to mention, Kurt, when I was trying to set up Carmen's living situation with the uncle now being the stepfather, in a sense, we know from her autopsy that she had been molested for a long period of time. She had scarring, and Carmen wanted to live with her grandparents as opposed to living with her uncle and her mother. And we strongly suspect that the Uncle Miguel had been molesting her for an extended period of time. And in order to remove herself from that situation, she wanted to live with the grandparents.
For a little bit of clarity, so that our audience knows that we're not really jaded on this, we understand the rules of evidence, and we know for a fact that Carmen was molested and that she had been molested over a long period of time. Obviously, we have no way of knowing that Miguel is the one that did that. It could have been your biological father, could have been somebody at schools, could have been somebody at church. There are plenty of other circumstances that it could have been other than Miguel. Simply bring up the fact that she was molested, and also the fact that despite being her half-sister Maria, Miguel's daughter, had made the argument during that presser with Michael Benson there, that author, that, you know, she had made the case that her father was a fastidious guy. He would have cleaned the car all the time anyway, that he was just a very clean, you know, person. But none of them, either Benson or her, mentioned that Miguel was scared, that he had to flee because after Carmen died, he was afraid that he was going to get caught living in the house there and not being on her case for social services. So basically they were getting food stamps and they were getting government assistance. Back then, government cheese was the big thing. So they were on public assistance, and the Department of Social Services there in Rochester did not know that Miguel was living in the house with the mother and ostensibly with Carmen. However, we have the uncle moving in now as like the stepfather, having a physical relationship with Carmen's mother, his brother's wife, and Carmen, for whatever reason, we don't know what reason, all we know for a fact is that Carmen did not want to live there with them.
Okay, can I butt in really quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know me, I like to look up things, and it says, most people who sexually abuse children are friends, partners, family members, or community members. About 93% of children who are victims of sexual abuse know their abuser, and a lot of the times it is the dad or stepdad figure.
Right.
Especially yes, if it's prolonged abuse, too.
Exactly.
Right. Well, that's the thing, because especially with it also has to deal with the age of the victim. The younger the child is, obviously, the less proximity and opportunity that anybody else is going to have, where the father or the stepfather is in the house with the kid late at night, everybody's sleeping, you can creep and tiptoe into the kid's room and do whatever it is you want to do, basically with impunity, because, you know, everybody's asleep and you're alone, solitude, isolation, where, you know, obviously a stranger isn't going to have that kind of access to your child, at least we hope they don't. Where they might be more tempted to do something like that. So the age of the child also has a lot to do with it, too.
I just found a crazy fact. What the heck? So this is from a research study on the Office of Justice Programs. It says 17% of women who had stepfathers in their childhood had been sexually abused in this study. Interesting.
Yes. Right.
So it's like super prevalent.
Oh, yeah. It lends itself to be more suspicious, because you have a very non-traditional sexual atmosphere in this house. Marriages fail all the time. Parents separate. They go their separate ways. In very, very few cases, does the mother then go on to the husband's brother? That's a rare occurrence. And it also adds a really weird, like, dynamic to the family, particularly around holidays, where your extended family usually comes together and you have your Thanksgivings and your Christmases and your Easters and your whatever holidays you have, throughout 4th of July picnics and all of that. That's really becomes a weird thing now when dad and uncle are like the same thing. You know, so dad, you can't really spend the holidays with your dad because your uncle is there. And you can imagine that your dad and and his brother are probably at each other's throats. You know, dad, there's nothing in the literature about that. But dad and uncle, you know, dad can't be too happy that his brother is shacking up with his wife and making another baby. So you have the wife, the mother, and she's got one kid with one brother and another kid with another guy. I mean, it sounds almost something biblical going on. This one dies and then you have to marry her and have a kid with everyone. Crazy. Crazy how that played out. The point that I'm trying to make is that despite being a Catholic family, the sexual perversity running through this family is well documented.
Also, Miguel just might have seen like a really vulnerable opportunity for both the mom and Carmen. There are these two like vulnerable women that would be easy access and easily to manipulate, and he could be right there, and he had the opportunity, so he could have just easily taken it.
Absolutely. And we don't know any of the history. Like, it could have been one of those things. You know, keep in mind, they were all pretty young back then, too. Matter of fact, what we found out in that video with Michael Benson, Carmen's mother had her when she was 14, which means she got pregnant probably when she was 13. Now, we don't know if, you know, she had a flirtatious thing going on with the brother. Maybe she was a little promiscuous and she was fooling around with both brothers behind each other's back, and her relationship with Miguel was longstanding. Maybe I'm just suggesting maybe it didn't start after the marriage broke up. The marriage might have even broken up because he found out that her and Miguel had something going on for an extended period of time. We don't know. But we're talking about a girl who's not only really impressionable, but really, really young. I mean, this was going on when she was 13, and she was having a baby when she was 14. So that definitely weighs into this, too. And then 10 years later, when Carmen gets abducted and disappears, the mother is only 24. So, really odd, that demographic that's going on. But the only point that I'm trying to make about this is that the family's moral compass is already off before we even get to the girl's abduction and murder and whatever the case may be. We know that the family as a whole, their moral compass is not pointing north. It's pointing somewhere else. So that being the case, anything is in play. Any kind of depravity that you can think of, that clearly this is a family that caves in or succumbs to their sexual desires. They don't think, they're more prone to thinking with their genitalia than they are to thinking with their brains. So as a result of this, there's got to be a reason. We don't know what the reason is, but we can speculate that because we know of the sexual abuse, we also know that Carmen was having severe nightmares or night terrors. And that is the number one telling symptom of a girl that age or any child that age, is that they're the victim of childhood sexual abuse, is when they have night terrors like that. And we know that Carmen was actually being treated by a doctor for these night terrors. So that leads more, and we know she was being sexually assaulted. We just don't know by who. However, because of the fact that she didn't want to live in the house with her mother and with Uncle Miguel, and she instead stayed with her grandparents, that really leads us to believe that there was something in the house that she was scared of. It was unsavory to her. It made living at home with her parents, or with her mother rather, not something that she would want to do, which to me casts more suspicion over Miguel's head. Ellie, what do you have on this?
Sorry, my mute button.
You're fine.
I'm in the realm of there's so much that's pointing towards Miguel in this. And then at the same time, so many things that exonerated some of the other suspects that I think in the beginning of this whole journey, we were pretty convinced on some of them. And even myself with Dennis Termini on this, being that he was a firefighter and that he had raped, you know, up to and there around maybe 14 girls in the area, but then DNA kind of exonerated him from that, and then a few of the other suspects. And so, you know, really as we've gone through this journey over this last, I'd say, gosh, it's been probably a month or a month and a half that we've been into this investigation on this case. It's been really some up and down hills with thinking that we've got this figured out, and then there's been this twist and turn. So I'm really starting to now narrow down, you know, one specific person for Wanda and Michelle, and absolutely probably the uncle separate for Carmen. And so these cases that seem to have clumped into one in the very beginning have now really kind of opened this investigation up to where I feel like we've got a clearer picture and some clarity on where we're going in this.
Absolutely. I agree. You know, really, really strange stuff going on here with these cases and, you know, the time difference and the lag. And again, the investigators didn't do a really good job. You know, we have a lot of eyewitness reports that the car on the side of the road was a luxury car, either a Cadillac or an LTD. But meanwhile, Miguel had a Pinto. But then you have all the people that said that there were two people in the car that got Carmen back that night. One of them even said that it was a woman, but we're not really put a lot of weight on that because it was only one person and it was dark outside already. So, you know, we just want to make sure that we clarify all of that, that we're not discounting that evidence. But go ahead, Matt. What do you got?
You know, Kurt, I know, you know, we're presenting information to you as a prosecuting attorney to try to bring criminal charges against this guy. And one valuable piece I feel like we also haven't included here was Carmen was strangled in a far different manner than the other two girls were.
Right.
She was strangled manually from the front and through some profiling experts and other data we have. This really tells us that this guy probably knew her and he had a different relationship with Carmen than Michelle and Wanda's killer did. And I would also like to present that to you as well, the way that she was strangled.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. The way that she was strangled, absolutely. Manual strangulation versus ligature strangulation. The other two victims were choked with either a rope or a belt. While we know that Carmen was killed with the killer's bare hands and while he was looking at her, the thumb marks we had in the last episode, we had our Dakota Bloyd, our resident coroner in attendance for the other episode where, you know, he explained that, you know, you can tell by the position of the bruising on the neck, you know, the position of the hands and whether it was from the front, whether it was from the back. It's excellent explanation that he gave there. So, yes, that definitely means that it's usually a lot more personal. And also the fact that her skull was fractured, her vertebra and her back was somebody really, really did a number on Carmen. There were clearly some anger issues and some emotions as far as the beating and the death of Carmen are concerned. That didn't exist in the other ones. There was a little bit of bruising with the other ones, but nothing to the extent of the injuries that Carmen suffered. So, point well taken there. All right. So I've gotten all of your evidence, and I appreciate everybody for making their case. I appreciate the attention to detail that's gone into the collection of all the evidence in this case. And now functioning as a prosecuting attorney, I am going to make my case based on the evidence, not only that was presented by our panel, but also by the evidence that's been presented that we've received through the FOIL requests and through our extensive searches for the last several weeks pertaining to this case, the crime scene photos and so forth. So with you, the public, and our panel now functioning as the grand jury, I'm going to make my case on whether we should indict and who it is we should attempt to indict. And then what we're going to do is on Friday night, we're going to go live, and then we will tabulate that at the beginning of the episode, and then we will all cast our votes at the end of Chapter 6, which, if the evidence is compelling enough, we can hope that we can present that evidence to the district attorney in the municipality that still has the investigation open, in this case, the Monroe County, New York Police Department and the district attorney's office there. If we find anything that we feel is compelling enough that they might not have looked at, we can absolutely present that to them in the hopes that it might light a fire under them and get them to reopen. The investigation isn't closed. We know that, but it's obviously cold. So I don't know if there's anybody working it on a day-to-day basis. If we present them with a comprehensive investigation, it might get them to bring the case a little bit more into the here and now.
Well, we know that Miguel, I'm presenting to you, Miguel, for the case of Carmen, because we know that if for sure during Michelle's murder, he was not in the area. And I don't believe he was in the area for Wanda. He at least had an alibi for Wanda. And he did not for Carmen.
Right. Right. So now I'm gonna levy to all of you on the panel and at home what I feel is the case here. As a prosecuting attorney in this case, I would go by who I believe we have the most evidence. There's a little bit of evidence against a lot of suspects in this case, but by far, I believe one stands out. And I believe in this case with my whole heart that there are absolutely two killers here. Again, we'll start with Carmen Colon, first of all, because she was the first victim, but also because the evidence in her case speaks a much different story to me than the other two girls. In that we know, again, Carmen was sexually assaulted. She had a lot of issues. Her family dynamic was, I believe, even more topsy-turvy than the other two girls. None of these girls had it easy. We know that. But in Carmen's case specifically, she was getting sexually abused, and we know that. Her mother separated from her father. That's traumatic enough. All of these girls, their mother separated from their father. But none of these other girls had to deal with their uncle moving in and having a physical relationship. So you have the extra drama of what's going on there and the dynamic between her biological father and her uncle, who's now living and sleeping with her mother as her stepfather. Just a really weird dynamic. So then you have the fact that she doesn't want to live at home. Whatever it is that's going on at home is disturbing enough to a 10-year-old girl that she just did not want to stay under the same roof and opted to go and stay with her grandparents. So we have that. We have the evidence from the eyewitnesses that saw Carmen running down the road, flailing her arms, which is another thing Mr. Benson said in his speech that discredits a lot of the things that he says in my eyes. He said that she was running down the road with her pants in her hands. We know this isn't true. The evidence shows that the pants were elsewhere away from her body, and all the eyewitnesses claim that she was running down the road, flailing her arms uncontrollably while she was running down the road, naked from the waist down. We also have the reports from all the eyewitnesses. It was unanimous that the vehicle that Carmen was running away from was a luxury sedan, a larger luxury sedan, either a Cadillac or a Ford LTD type vehicle. Now, Miguel didn't have a luxury vehicle. He had a Pinto. That's been well documented. However, almost all of the eyewitness reports that we saw showed that there were, or reported that there were two people in the car, not just one. And that the person getting out of the passenger side of the car is the one that ran down Carmen and grabbed her and put her back in the car. Now, one of those witnesses, and there were over 100, I think there was actually closer to 200, but one of those witnesses claimed that they knew for a fact that the person getting out of the passenger seat of the car and going after Carmen was a woman. Again, that they're the only witness to say that. I think it's very possible that Miguel had a friend or possibly another relative that we're not particularly aware of their name or their circumstances. Their name's been kept out of it because they haven't been charged or accused of any kind of crime. But I believe it's very possible that he had a friend or a relative that he recruited to use their car. You know, when he finally decided that it was time to do what he was going to do to Carmen, ultimately, and the girl got away. So this way, it fits with the evidence. The whole idea of presenting a case to a grand jury is we have to focus on the evidence. We can suppose from the evidence different theories and different hypotheses, but ultimately...
Do you think the mother was the one in the car?
I don't. I don't believe that Carmen's mother would have played any part in doing that to her. I just don't.
The reason I asked that is if there was prolonged molestation going on, she probably knew about it. Carmen probably told her, she may have seen it. And Carmen wants to live with the grandparents now. They're afraid that the stepdad's going to get in trouble.
Right. Well, it's very possible that she told the mother that she was being sexually abused by Miguel. And it's also very possible, as we've seen in case study after case study after case study, that the mother that the mother often sides with the sexual partner rather than with the child. There are numerous documented cases, actually more than 50%, more than half of them, where the child has reported to the mother that they're being abused by the father or the stepfather, and the mother just refuses to believe them and refuses to act. They instead believe that it's some kind of jealousy on the part of the child, the fact that the child wants the mother and the father to get back together again, so they're going to do anything to put a wedge in between the mother and the new relationship. I really don't think there was a woman in the car. I don't believe that there was, you know, unless you want to make the argument, again, that this was like an Elizabeth Smart type thing, where there was some husband and wife couple that was out, you know, cruising for recruits that were going to be there in the woods or chained up in the barn, like sex slave or whatever the case. You know, if you're going to try and make that argument, that's the guilty party. That's fine. I don't think the evidence points there. I don't think the evidence points there at all. When Carmen got out of came out of the pharmacy without the prescription in her hands, yelling to the pharmacist, I gotta go, and running out of the pharmacy, she got into a car, and the car that she got into was reported by the witnesses there in front of the pharmacy as being a Pinto. That's where the evidence of the Pinto came in. So a lot of people just assume that the car on the side of the road was a Pinto, and it was not. A matter of fact, there isn't a single witness that saw the car on the side of the road and saw Carmen running from it that said that it was a Pinto. They unanimously said it was a large luxury car. So whether or not the second person in the car was a woman or a man, I don't really think is relevant, because I think that's kind of like taking us down a rabbit hole that we just don't need to go. So that being said, with the evidence in case, after watching Maria Colon in that video that we watched for the book writer and his presser, you know, after watching her, she didn't have the words. Now, granted, she might not be a good conversationalist. She might not be good in front of crowds of people. She might not just have a good public speaking presence or aura about her. But honestly, I found what she said to not be credible. A matter of fact, if she was a witness on the witness stand, I would almost certainly accuse her of lying. I believe she's trying to protect the legacy of her father, but we already know that her father is not an honorable, good man. She tried to paint a picture in that video, and so did the author, which made him lose credibility in my mind. They try to paint a picture together that Miguel was an upstanding citizen that was just trying to do the right thing. And clearly he's not trying to do the right thing. You don't get involved in a sexual relationship with your brother's wife if you're trying to do the right thing. Can't definitively say that he was the one sexually abusing Carmen, but there's a pretty good chance it was him, just because of lack of options of anybody else. He was living in the house with Carmen's mother without being on her social services account. So clearly he has a disregard for the law. They had to know. They didn't just find out after Carmen died that they were breaking the law. They had to know they were breaking the law when they agreed on that arrangement in the first place. And until Carmen was killed, nobody clearly cared about it. So these are all things. What do you have, Matt?
You had me worried when you brought up the sister. I thought, oh, no, you're going to say she's credible. But you're absolutely right on the facts you brought up. And one other thing to add to that, she tried to defend him cleaning the car as to say, oh, my dad kept a very clean car. He always cleaned it. I've cleaned many cars in my day. I don't ever remember using bleach. Bleach right. is used for a specific purpose, but you're absolutely right. She's trying to defend something.
Right. And, you know, it's crazy that there are a lot of potential suspects in this case, but particularly in the case of Carmen, where you have the extreme violence that was perpetrated on her body. You have the fact that the killer never bothered to redress her like it did with the other girls. A lot of the staging of the crime scenes would lead me to believe that this was not done by the same person. And I understand that the authorities that are investigating this case now said publicly a couple of times that they have evidence that they're not releasing that they believe conclusively ties all the cases together. And that's possible. But of course, we can't talk about evidence we don't have. However, I believe when the nature of that evidence is revealed, if it's ever revealed, we're going to find out that a potential second killer of Wanda and Michelle could absolutely have faked that evidence and done it in a copycat kind of way. In other words, staged their scenes deliberately to look like it was possibly the killer of Carmen Colón. So I believe that there was probably a very good reason for the killer in this case to make it look like a serial episode by copycatting as closely as they could with the information they had at the time, Carmen's crime scene, without realizing, of course, that they failed miserably.
Well, it might also be a good time to mention, I don't know, for presentation to the district attorney or prosecuting attorney, but the whole alphabet thing was almost really imposed by the press, right? And they were making connections with where they were found and their initials, and that wasn't even entirely accurate because Carmen was not found in Churchville. She was actually somewhere else, wasn't she?
That's exactly right. Yeah, she was found in a town called Riga.
So we have three girls that got killed in a similar fashion, but I think joining the three of them together was probably for hype, really, and the facts say that they probably weren't the same.
Well, exactly right. And like I said, at the time, you know, we don't have direct access to news reports that were released about the cases back then. I looked, and I, because I wanted to see if any of the local television stations down there reported on these cases, and if those reports are still surviving. I could not find any. But based on the type of cases in the 70s and 80s that were reported on TV, a lot of the details, the intricate details of the cases, were left out because they were considered indecent back at that time. The, you know, the blue laws that were in effect, the three TV channels that everybody got back in the early 70s had really strong censorship laws and rules where they would, there would be absolutely no swearing on TV. There'd be absolutely no nudity on TV. There would be absolutely no anything that could recently be considered not wholesome. It wasn't going to make it onto the air. So you could guarantee that they weren't going to be broadcasting the difference between manual strangulation and ligature strangulation, and how somebody cracked her skull in on a rock, how they choked the life out of her while they looked into her eyes and watched the light dim as her life energy escaped from her body. These are things that you're likely to see in a 2023 newscast. There are things that you absolutely would never see in a 1971 newscast. So I believe that based on the information that they received through the media that did not have all the facts, I believe that's what allowed the second killer in the Michelle Mayenza and Wanda Walkowitz cases to try to emulate and simulate what occurred in the case of Carmen Colón. But of course, they did a horrible job because they didn't have all the details. So when they heard that Carmen Colón was choked to death or strangled, they didn't have any way of knowing it was done with the bare hands from the front. So being completely detached from their next victims, they used a belt or a rope and they did it from behind, thinking that they were copycatting the killer. That's my take. That's what this reminds me of. And it reminds me of that for the simple fact that the second two cases are so closely related in all the details, all the intimate and intricate details, that it almost guarantees that the first case has to be an outlier. So we have that. So based on the facts and what we know, I would move the panel to issue an indictment against a posthumous indictment against Miguel Colón, who, as we know, as part of his weakened character and his poorly pointed moral compass, after all the things that he did, turned around and shot his brother or his brother-in-law and his wife, and then put the gun on himself and killed himself. These are not the acts of a wholesome man, as Maria Colón would have us believe in her little interview there. So while I can fully appreciate and understand the love of a daughter for her father, and that she would say and do anything to keep his memory untarnished, I believe fully that Miguel Colón was not only sexually abusing Carmen for an extended period of time, but also in this case was her killer. Now, the logistics of how she came into the car and got into the Pinto, and then they went somewhere and changed cars and got into a luxury sedan and had a second person in the car, ostensibly, whoever it is that owned the Cadillac or the Ford LTD or whatever the luxury car was that was caught on there, there was, I believe, somebody owned that property. So all of this being said, I'm convinced that Miguel Colon is the guilty party and should be indicted for the murder of Carmen Colon back in November of 1971. That moves us to the other two girls. As I mentioned at the beginning of Chapter 5, we had a couple of more suspects in this case than what was originally released to us when we were doing our investigation through the other FOIA materials. Now, ironically, in none of the FOIA materials did we get anything about Theodore F. Given. That's G-I-V-E-N. There's no S at the end of his name. It's just Theodore F. Given. We went through quite a bit of his history and his past. He definitely has he's a confirmed and confessed pedophile. Got several convictions for rape, several convictions for statutory rape, several convictions for murder. Of course, he served all of his time. He maxed out on his sentence there in New York, and he was then civilly committed into a hospital for the criminally insane, which he remains to this day. As mentioned in earlier episodes, he could, if he's ever pronounced sane, obviously he could walk right out of there. He's not being held by any type of criminal punishment anymore. So the first time a doctor would step up and claim that he's cured and he's sane, he also becomes a free man. I was compelled by the fact that our author in that video that we found claims to have opened a written dialogue with Given over the course of about a year where, you know, he had corresponded with him back and forth. It was intriguing that Given had mentioned in those letters, again, according to the author, he didn't show us any evidence of it. But I'm assuming it's in his book. I haven't read his book. I don't have any intention of reading it because a lot of his facts are flawed and very easily, very easily debunked. If we're to believe the fruit of his correspondence with this madman Given, Given had a lot of predeceived notions about, it shouldn't be called the double initial killings. It should be called the alphabet killings. I believe Benson is so adamant on the double initial killings because all the other commercial stuff out there about this case calls it the alphabet killings. So this is more of a commercial ploy than it is anything else. By naming it the double initials killer or the double initials killings, he's separating himself from the rest and trying to convince the community that his book stands apart and that his research is exemplary and is much more thorough and convincing and factually accurate than everybody else's. And from what we know to be facts in the case, we know that that's not true. We know that a lot of the suppositions that he made and a lot of the things that he expressed as facts are not actually facts. So because of that, I discredit a lot of what he had to say. And I firmly believe, for several reasons, because of the proximity, his father's house being about two football fields away from Michelle Mayenze's house, one of the victims that he dumped later on in life, the 14-year-old girl that he killed, he dumped at the entrance to Michelle Mayenze's school, the school that she was leaving from on the day she was abducted and killed. On her way home, she never made it, and she would have come out that same door. So he actually dumped that girl's body there at that location. There are just an awful lot of things that tie Given in with our scenarios here. And it's because of that. It's because of his sexual sadism. It's because of his love for prepubescent girls. It's because of the trickery and deceit that he used to try and isolate his victims. All of these matters put together lead me to believe that Theodore Given is, in fact, the killer of Wanda Walkowitz and Michelle Mayenze. I don't have any doubt of that in my own mind. Pressler would have been a good candidate for the simple fact that his victim, Michelle McMurray, who was 6 years old when she was abducted and killed there in the late 70s, was also a double initial case that was ultimately solved in 2001 when the DNA analyst analyzed a cigarette butt that was found near Michelle McMurray's body, and the DNA sample came back to James Pressler. So unfortunately, Pressler died while he was still in Florida, in Key West, Monroe County. So he never got to stand and face justice for what he did to Michelle McMurray. I've repeatedly said that I don't understand why, up until the point that he was singled out and identified, that he was never even suggested as a possible suspect, or that Michelle McMurray was part of the alphabet or double initial murders, whatever you want to call it. But I would myself, as a district attorney, petition the courts to have a DNA sample taken. I believe there is enough probable cause to have a DNA sample taken of Given and have it compared to the DNA profile that we have on file from the body of Wanda Walkowitz. And I believe that when they do, if they ever do, get that sample, they will absolutely prove that Given is, in fact, the killer of Michelle Mayenza and Wanda Walkowitz. Also of incredible insight, in our Gifted Insights episode with the amazing Gina Nisanoff, our resident psychic, just an incredible, incredible case where she mentions that she saw the killer bringing these children to a basement and then doing vile things to them in the basement and killing them there in a house. And sure enough, Given's MO is that he used to abduct these girls around the neighborhood, bring them to an abandoned house there in Rochester, tie them up in the basement while he brutalized the other one or ones up in a room, one of the bedrooms, with a dirty mattress on the floor before ultimately letting them go again. So there are some similarities where he didn't kill all of his victims. There are definitely other dissimilarities where the victims didn't have the same initials in some of the cases. But what we also find is a lot of time transpired in between the murders of Michelle Mayenza and Wanda Walkowitz and when he picked up his killing spree back in 1984. For 10 years, from 1974 to 1984, Given was incarcerated. And when he got out, the killing resumed. But in the 10 years that he spent incarcerated, it is not a far-fetched notion that his desires in the way he killed, all the hours that he spent in a jail cell looking at the ceiling and contemplating the crimes of his past, that he developed new passions and new lusts and new fantasies that he wanted to lay out. So it is more than common where killers such as this and rapists such as this, when they're forced to endure extended periods of abstinence from their crimes and their criminal endeavors, that they morph and turn into something more. In their mind, they're evolving, although in the minds of most of us, they're devolving. But in their mind, they're evolving and they're becoming something greater than what they were. And these killings only ultimately personify and exemplify that. So that being said, I am also, out of all of the witnesses, we know Michelle and we know Wanda were killed by the same perpetrator. So I am convinced beyond doubt that that perpetrator is Theodore F. Given, who is still civilly committed in that asylum in upstate New York, geared towards the mentally unstable. With that, my recommendation, my formal recommendation to the grand jury is that they issue indictments for, number one, Miguel Colon for the murder and rape of Carmen Colon, and for Theodore F. Given for the murder and rapes of Wanda Walkowitz and Michelle Mayenza. I would also compel the court to, upon probable cause hearing, issue court order and a warrant to secure the DNA of Mr. Given so that it can be secured and compared and analyzed against the samples that were found on the body of the girls. Also, it is important to see if at any point in the case, Given had White Cat. We had mentioned earlier that white cat hair was in play on the bodies of Wanda Walkowitz and Michelle Mayenza. Mr. Benson, in his video, incorrectly claims that all three victims had white cat hair on their bodies, liberal amounts of white cat hair on their bodies. And as a result of that, that is the only piece and comprehensive clue that they have that all three of these cases are related. So I would like to see that. I would like to see them do a little bit more extensive search on the white animal and see if they could find traces of cat hair or a lineage of where, who might have owned a white cat that could have contributed hair that was similar to that at that time. So that would be definitely what I would go for as a request of the grand jury. One, again, an indictment against Miguel Colon for the rape and murder of Carmen Colon, and one indictment against Theodore F. Given for the rapes and murders of Wanda Walkowitz and Michelle Mayenza. That, folks, concludes episode number 5. We want to thank you for tuning in. After this airs, the chat rooms are going to be open. The polls are going to be up in our Facebook discussion group. Please go there. Again, it's facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. For all of us here at the Veritas 7 True Crime Podcast, I'm Kurt Dillon with Steph Clark, Matt Sloniker, Paige Smith, Danny Lott, Ellie Sherrill, and all the rest of our cast and crew. We want to thank you for helping us to revolutionize the way we bring you podcasts. We hope you enjoy this format. We want to hear all of your comments, all of your concerns, whether they're critiques, whether they're compliments, whatever it is. The podcast is designed to suit you, so we want to hear what you have to say. Make sure you go in, again, facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. Cast your vote on who you would indict, if you thought it was able to indict, and let us know your opinions on the evidence as we've presented it. And we'll be back right after this.
I can't believe the price of dog food is getting outrageous. And if I want to save a few bucks, I have to carry a 50-pound bag of kibble up the stairs into my apartment. There has to be a better way.
There is. I'm so glad you said something. You poor thing, we've been using TummyTimePetSupplies.com for over a year now.
Tummy Time Pet Supplies? What's that?
TummyTimePetSupplies.com. They have all the major brands and most smaller brands as well. In fact, we not only get all of our dog and cat supplies there, but they also have everything we need for Brett's chinchilla, Ashley's ferrets, Haley's iguana, and even Jordan's pet tarantula.
Wow, they sell all that?
And more. But what's best about TummyTimePetSupplies.com is that they ship everything through Amazon Fulfillment. That means that everything you order gets delivered right to your door, and if you're an Amazon Prime customer, shipping is almost always free. That really sounds incredible, but I bet it's super expensive. Mark just got laid off and I can't afford all those special conveniences for a while. Nonsense. In fact, Tummy Time offers some of the most reasonable prices anywhere. You really have to be a whiz and coupon shopping to beat their everyday prices, and when they run sales, forget about it. I can't believe it, an incredible selection, great prices, and right to your door service. So what do you think?
I think the next time I buy anything for my pets, I'm going to TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
I think that's a very wise choice.
Me too.
That's right. For all your pet needs, it's TummyTimePetSupplies.com. Remember, TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that does it for part 2 of the Alphabet Murders Prime episode. We're just about there. Only one more segment left. Chapter 6, The Verdict. It's coming. Stand by. Get ready for the release. You're not going to want to miss it. What you need to do if you want to participate in The Verdict is you need to join our Facebook fan group at facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. When you go in there, there are live chats that are available. You'll see them when you go in. Click on and enter into the chats, and there will be people in there all hours of the day and night discussing this and all of the other cases that we cover. and some end cases that we haven't covered. We have people in there that are discussing cases we haven't covered yet, or that they want us to cover. So really good conversation in there. We have excellent people in the group. You definitely want to get in there and get in and be part of the conversation. But in those chat groups is also where we will be taking our polls on who it is that you believe are the guilty party or parties. So if you want to have a voice in it, by all means, go over, join the group, facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. Go in, join up. You're going to have a blast. It's a great group. We have a great bunch of people in there. So you definitely want to do that. For now, that's it for all of us here at the Veritas 7. Stay safe and have a fantastic night. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. So turn the car around and leave. Meet me underneath the tree inside the valley that we made. And with our hands we'll make the best of the life that we have left. And we will never say goodbye. Inside the valley that we made. And with our hands we'll make the best of the life that we have left. And we will never say goodbye. And if we do we'll meet again, knowing love was heaven sent. And I've never felt this way.